The mind of man is composed of numerous faculties which may be divided into two grand divisions called, respectively, animal and intellectual. By animal faculties we mean such as are possessed by man and beast, or we might simply say by animals, for man is only an intellectual animal. As examples of this class of faculties, we may mention alimentiveness, combativeness, destructiveness, amativeness, philoprogenitiveness, etc. In man, they are usually called propensities, but in lower animals, they are called instincts. Paul calls them the carnal mind and tells us, quote, "It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be," unquote. Romans 8 and verse 7. It would do but little good to read the Ten Commandments to a horse, as he would not be subject to them. Neither indeed could he be. And it would do about as little good to read them to the purely carnal mind of man, if it were possible to do so, composed of similar constituents, which knows no law but animal gratification. But God has given to man an intellectuality capable of appreciating law, and has given him a law adapted to his organization by which his carnal propensities are to be exercised and by which the whole man is to be governed. And while the whole man is governed by laws received from God and applied by the intellectual man, all is harmony and order and without sin. But when these laws are superseded by animal propensities, such as appetites, passion, and lust, then come confusion, violence, and crime. And thus originated sin in the garden. God gave Adam a law for the government of his appetite, and while he obeyed it, he had life and peace. But when law was supplanted by appetite, sin came, and death by sin. From the description of man's nature found in the creeds, it would seem that the authors regard these animal propensities as filling the entire measure of the human mind. But the duality of mind is well established by experience, observation, metaphysics, reason, and the Bible. The carnal mind we have already seen. The perspective and reflective faculties, of which there are many, and the moral sentiments such as benevolence, veneration, conscientiousness, firmness, hope, etc., make up the intellectual and moral nature of man to which God's law is addressed. And Paul tells us, "They that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace." Romans chapter 8, verses 5 and 6. The antagonism of these two departments of man's nature is well shown in Paul's description of himself. "I find then," says he, "a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. For I delight in the law of God after the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members." Romans 7, verses 21 through 23. Had this dual nature been dispensed with in the creation of man, he must have been all animal, and therefore nothing more than a brute. Or he must have been all intellectual and moral, without any counter tendencies in his nature, and therefore would have been a mere machine, acting as compelled to act under one set of principles, and hence there would have been neither merit nor demerit in anything he did. Nor could he have had the slightest freedom of will, and therefore could not have been in the slightest degree accountable to his Creator, who, in that event, would have been operating him as a mechanic does his machine. But if we can arrive at the meaning of the language, "dying thou shalt die," as connected with the law given to and violated by Adam, then we think we may arrive at a knowledge of the kind of death he died. This we certainly can do with great clearness, as we have an exegesis of the language by God himself. After Adam violated the law, God adjudicated his case and pronounced the sentence upon him. Both as the giver of the law and as God, he certainly knew what he meant by the language of the law, and he certainly pronounced the sentence in accordance therewith. What then was the sentence? Quote, "Dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return." Unquote. Genesis 3, verse 19. Surely this must mean literal physical death. Nothing more, nothing less. Moses wrote the history of this affair about 2,500 years after it occurred, when the word die in all its forms was of no doubtful import, but had a well-settled meaning in the current usage of that day. A few examples may not be out of place here. In the 5th chapter of Genesis, we have the word employed by the same writer no less than 8 times as follows: "And all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died." Verse 5. "And all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died." Verse 8. "And all the days of Enos were 905 years, and he died." Verse 11. "And all the days of Cainan were 910 years, and he died." Verse 14. "And all the days of Mahalaleel were 895 years, and he died." Verse 17. "And all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died." Verse 20. "And all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died." Verse 27. "And all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died." Verse 31. These cases clearly show what Moses understood by the word die, and as he is the same writer that recorded the law violated by Adam, he must have meant the same by die in the law that he meant in the other cases referred to. Again, the word die must certainly mean just the opposite of the word live. This word in its various forms occurs in the same chapter to indicate physical life. Had God afflicted Adam with greater punishment than the terms employed indicated to him, then would he not have deceived him? And he determined upon other and greater punishment for him after he committed the act than that threatened in the law violated, then we insist that it was ex post facto in its character, and therefore unjust. The circumstances under which Adam violated God's law would have rather invoked a commutation of punishment than an increase of it. He did not know good and evil until he acquired a knowledge of it by eating the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This is evident from the language of God after he ate of it. Quote, "Behold, the man is become as one of us, to know good and evil." Unquote. Genesis 3 and verse 22. He could only appropriate the law as a positive prohibition, but his moral obligation to obey God as his creator he could not appreciate. He could not so much as know that he was naked, for God said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" Genesis 3 and verse 11. Certainly then, if ignorance be a mitigating circumstance, Adam was entitled to the full benefit of it. From our standpoint, such a thought as spiritual corruption by inheritance is utterly impossible. Paul says, "We have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live?" Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 9. Does not this passage plainly prove that the fathers of our flesh are not the fathers of our spirits? To our mind it shows that while our bodies are inherited from our parents, the spirit is not so inherited, but comes directly from God. Hence the style, "fathers of our flesh, the father of spirits." Our bodies we inherit from our parents, and consequently, physical impurities may be transmitted from parent to child, but we suppose all will agree that the mind, the spiritual or inner man, is the seat of moral depravity. If then we do not get our spirits by inheritance, it is impossible that we should inherit spiritual depravity from Adam. May we further examine the scriptures on this subject? Quote, "The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him." Unquote. Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 1. If God forms the spirit within man, it seems improbable that he gets it by inheritance. Again, Solomon says, "Then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return to God who gave it." Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 7. By this we learn not only that the spirit returns to God at death, but that God originally gave it. The words "returns to God" clearly imply that it had been there before. We cannot say we returned to a place to which we had never been. In returning, it did not go in or with the body, as the body returned to the ground as dust. As therefore the spirit returns independent of the body, is it not likely that God gave it to man, not by or through the body, but for the body? The words "God who gave it" have somewhat the same ring, too. Nevertheless, they alone would not be quite conclusive, for he gives us food, raiment, and many other things through means prepared to produce them. The question for us, then, is, does he give the Spirit through means or without means? Does he give it directly or indirectly? Does he give it as we have seen that he takes it, or does he give it by procreation, organization, or some other means? Let us see. When Jesus restored the ruler's dead daughter to life, Luke said, "Her spirit came again, and she arose straightway." Luke 8 and verse 55. The spirit of the damsel came again. From whence did it come? Solomon says the spirit returns to God who gave it. Then it is clear that her spirit went to God when she died and came directly from him when she was made alive. The words "came again" imply that it had done the same thing before. And as we have no account of her being miraculously made alive before, it follows that it was at the beginning of her existence that her spirit came directly from God the previous time. But we are told that the spiritual man did not come directly from God, but is from the creature of the organization. We have not room for a thorough examination of this objection here, but we must notice it briefly, not by way of respect for materialistic infidelity, of which it is the cornerstone, but in respect to our own argument against which it may be presented. First, then, if the Spirit came not from God, how are the scriptures above quoted and the reasonings therefrom to be met? And how can a material organization create an immaterial soul capable of existence separate from the organization after the latter has ceased to be? Or if the soul, created by materiality, is itself material, why is it not subject to chemical analysis? The material organization is not only subject to chemical analysis, but has been analyzed repeatedly. The ultimate elements of it have been found, and if the soul is also material, why has it not been subjected to the same process? Surely the advocates of materialism have the ability to do so if it were possible, and the defense of their theory would invoke the disposition to do it. If they, then, have not done it, it is clear that because of the soul's immateriality, they cannot do it. That the soul is capable of existence after separation of soul and body is clear from what we have already quoted from Solomon, that the body returns to the ground and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Not only so, but it is also clear from numerous other passages. Paul says, "Therefore we are always confident, knowing that whilst we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. We are confident and willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord." 2 Corinthians 5, verses 6 through 8. John saw under the altar the souls of them that were slain for the word of God. Revelation 6 and verse 9. We might further quote Luke 16, 24 and 27 concerning the rich man and Lazarus, and many other scriptures on this subject, but enough has been quoted to satisfy those who read and believe the Bible, and others will not likely read what we write about it. The body may be likened to a machine controlled by the mind or spiritual man. No machinery has ever been known capable of generating its own motive power. Hence, the perpetual motion has not been invented. If the human organism creates the soul its own motive power, then it is an exception to all known law on the subject. If, then, our argument holds good and the Spirit came not by inheritance, but directly from God, it follows that when it is given, it is not only good, but very good, and the whole theory of hereditary depravity is most certainly false. The child comes into the world with its infantile mind composed of numerous faculties susceptible of being cultivated and developed by impressions made upon it through the senses, and when all its faculties are properly balanced, educated, and governed, they are calculated to make the man useful and happy, but if neglected, may make him vicious and miserable, and his inclinations to virtue and vice depend much upon the circumstances and influences surrounding him. Hence, inclinations to sin are as different in different persons as the circumstances have been different by which they have been influenced from infancy to manhood. We most firmly believe that many men who were raised under improper influences and became desperately wicked, perhaps terminated their lives upon a scaffold, if they had been raised under wholesome influences, would have been useful members of society and finally saved in heaven, and vice versa. Thus we see the importance of observing Solomon's admonition. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old he will not depart from it. With which Paul agrees, saying, bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. But there are differences of mental power manifested by different persons growing out of a difference in the physical machinery inherited from our parents. This we not only admit, but firmly believe. But these do not affect our position in the least. An engine may run a vast amount of well-made and properly applied machinery and thus exhibit great power, but were we to apply the same engine to heavy, cumbersome, unwieldy, unbalanced machinery, it could do but little, though the same man operated it. So a man who has inherited a fine organization, large and well-defined brain, of fine material, will exhibit much more mental power than one who had inherited an imperfect organization of coarse material. But inherited weakness, whether physical or mental, is not sin. No guilt can attach to it. And therefore the differences in mental power spoken of cannot prove the doctrine of total depravity. On the contrary, if they prove anything concerning it, they contradict it. For these differences cannot be the result of total depravity, because all who are totally depraved are, in this respect, exactly alike. There is no comparative degree in total depravity.